We break down Dallas's game one victory in Minnesota, an instant reaction to the expected news that JB Bickerstaff was let go in Cleveland, and a look behind the curtain at Philadelphia's offseason plans. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, it's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. What is up?
Jake, I am so excited to be in the conference finals right now, to have reached this peak.
Yeah, you've made it. You have won two series to get here.
That's right. Exactly. I've persevered. And listen, you know, I'm not going to lie. They had me in the first half. I was down. I wasn't feeling good. But, you know, sometimes, you know, at this point, you got to push through, like, tired legs after watching games, you know, the difficulty of a quick turnaround. But, you know, here we are, man. And, you know, we've started in both conferences, and now we're just on that push to the finish line. So I'm feeling good. How about yourself?
I'm good. There's a lot going on in the household.
Do tell.
I had to rewatch Mavs Minnesota this morning because we got a foster dog yesterday.
No way.
Yeah. It's been an experience. But the lady friend wants to adopt, like, desperately, and I've just been on the road so much, and pretty much at some point while I was in Chicago for the draft combine, she FaceTimed me and basically said, "F it, we're getting a dog." And I said, "Go for it," as my mom calls me, probably checking in on the dog.
Of course. I mean, listen, it's an important step in any grandparent's life, would-be grandparent's life, to find out if there's a new pet. Okay, I know we need to get to basketball, and we will get there briefly. Sorry, everybody, but I need to know, like, big dog, little dog, what are we talking about here?
Her name is Arugula.
Okay.
The batch of foster dogs, I think, are all veggies because she's taking her to an adoption event on Saturday with, like, bok choy and broccolini and dill. These are all the names of the dogs.
Okay.
She's about 40 pounds,
all right,
which is 10 pounds bigger than my preferred range.
No, big dogs are good because big dogs are bigger than little dogs. And I think that's something you got to consider. Bigger dogs are good.
I think 30 is a sweet spot for me personally, but it's fine. She's so sweet. She slept through the night.
Hell but yeah.
Yeah, just setting up the Ethernet cord to the living room, and I don't know what's going on outside, but she's been great. Only had one little accident so far. Nothing too crazy. She peed outside this morning. So
that's awesome. I manage one accident per podcast as we are. So, like, you know, if she's already getting outside, sleeping through the night, this is great. She's doing better than most of us at this point in the playoffs. That is wonderful news. I'm excited for you.
Thank you.
I'm going to put the marker down here. I mean, you know, it's a foster dog. If you do need at some point a sitter, you know, we are set up for that. And I think the girls would love it. So anyway, that's very, very
appreciate
cool.
That. Yeah. When we have our forever dog and we need a sitter, I will add you to the list of people that we are compiling slowly.
Actually, it just occurred to me, I might have to jackass my way to Williamsburg for that. Take me off. I don't think I want to do that.
We'll take her to you. We'll take her to you.
All right. That sounds good.
Yeah. We'll touch maybe on more dogs later. We'll touch on Philly and their offseason plans to get another top dog. Look at that.
Look at that, Segway King.
Sadly, we're also going to talk about JB Bickerstaff being out in Cleveland, news that broke just before we started recording. But yeah, first, as now my mom's FaceTiming, because I'm just going to do it live on the show. I'm just going to do it.
Go for it.
Mom, I'm doing a podcast. We can't be calling. Nope, it's a pocket dial. There we go. Even better. All right. I'm going to put my phone on. Do not disturb.
There it is. Professionalism.
Yeah. Mavericks 108. Timberwolves 105. Dallas up 1-0. First time in six playoff series under Jason Kidd that they've won a game one in a series, which kind of wild. I don't think there's anything really to elaborate on there other than it is a statistic that broke a trend that, you know, covering. Stop calling me mother. Jesus Christ.
Most of us get your mom's takes on the game one trend being broken.
She spent many a night watching me and my younger brother from the stands to the point where the story got retold recently. It was early in my high school basketball career when, you know, I'm trying to assimilate to the coaching style of the school, not the AU program I played before, not the travel program I played before. I'm trying to be a good soldier in this new army I've joined and enlisted in. And she's yelling the direct opposite of what I'm being told to do by the coaching staff, to the point where I was worried that the coaching staff would think I was trying to go on me and not on we. So I yelled at my mother in front of this whole gym, "Can you please shut up?" as I just did right now.
Jake, I hate to be the bearer of bad news here.
It's still a memory.
You are the one who was wrong about that.
I was wrong. I was wrong.
you were. I understand you're trying to be part of the team, but that's one that's never gonna.
No.
That's gonna live in the memory, the collective memory.
That's why it's been brought up 15 years later. So
I think the main takeaway from the game one trend is that the Mavs blew it. You know, winning game one, they've gotten off on the wrong foot. They've been successful so far by losing game one, and now here they are breaking the streak. Bad idea.
Yeah. Why don't you, to get us on task, just do what you do and analyze, and we can get our listeners somewhere productive, even though I have done a terrible job of hosting so far.
You're not doing, Jake, you're doing a great job. Just don't tell me to shut up while I'm talking from the stands. This is why you pair Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, right? Like 63 points combined between the two of them. Kyrie scores 24 of his 30 in the first half. Luka scores 15 of his 33 in the fourth quarter to bring Dallas home. And this was like the kind of game plan response that Dallas had in the first couple of rounds, as, you know, the opponents were trying to force the ball out of Luka and Kyrie's hands. And all of a sudden, PJ Washington is knocking down shots and Derek Jones Jr. is knocking down shots. Josh Green's getting a corner three and drilling it. Like, that stuff was almost entirely dried up in this game. And it was, can Kyrie Irving and Luka Doncic create against the best defense in the NBA and make enough shots to weather a like wild shooting performance from the Wolves from long distance? And the answer to that was yes. Like, we'll get into, you know, maybe a little bit later, the discussion and debate over how Minnesota plays drop coverage and whether Rudy Gobert's drop defense is tenable against pull-up shooters like Luka and Kyrie and so on and so forth. But I think the big thing was, like, Kyrie Irving came out. It was the most aggressive first half he's had, I think, this entire postseason. He's been excellent in second halves to this point in the playoffs, but this was very clear very early. Like, he was trying to put his fingerprints on the game and say, and he said, I think, during his between quarters interview on the court and then also when he was on the set with the Inside the NBA guys, like, they're coming off the game seven. We needed to get into their legs. We needed to be aggressive. We needed to go, and they're a great defense. We needed to try to get them before they were set. And Dallas wasn't like a super, they didn't get a ton in transition. They didn't have a ton of fast break points, but Kyrie was just repeatedly over and over again, when he had the opportunity, attacking. You know, you get to half court, you see that there's no rim protector back there, hit the gas. You know, you have an opportunity to turn, just sort of maybe an empty possession late in a quarter into something where you can get something progressive going to the rim, hit the gas. And it's forced them to guard you. His imprint and his, you know, the physicality, the speed, the pace he was playing with, the way he was moving, it forced Minnesota to like snap to attention. And when Dallas got down early, Kyrie's pace really was pretty big in getting them back into the game late in the first quarter, and then sort of really being able to weather the storm while Luka wasn't firing well, while he was having a little bit of trouble with Jaden McDaniel's length, with finding his spots. And then by the time that Kyrie kind of ran out of gas a little bit offensively, Luka was ready to take over. It is the ideal of what they were hoping to get out of the trade they made at the deadline in 2023 to bring Kyrie in, supported by the ideal of what they were looking to get at the 2024 deadline with Daniel Gafford, with PJ Washington, and all the size and physicality they brought to bear. This is why Dallas on the right night looks like they can win the championship, and they've been having a lot more right nights than wrong nights recently.
Yeah, having covered that series against OKC for 4 out of the 6 games. Yeah, I missed 2 because I was in Chicago. It's really remarkable how Kyrie looks like Kyrie and talks like Kyrie, but he's such a different Kyrie at the same time. The poise, the like veteran, sage, elder. It's interesting. I didn't look this up until I was penning my series opus about kind of crowning the Mavericks front office as team building champions, that he's precisely the exact age gap or seniority, 8 years older than Luka, than LeBron was when LeBron joined Cleveland.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they just kind of have, it is not the same dynamic at all, but 6'7", super generational passer. They kind of see the game from a similar procedural operative lens, but different, more artistic from Kyrie, more like surgical from Luka. But the balance that they have found, which to your point about Kyrie coming out from the start, it had been so throughout the first two rounds, it had been so evident that Kyrie was just sitting back and picking his spots and letting Luka do him. So that change was definitely notable. And I think it's just a further illustration of how Kyrie's kind of become this offensive chameleon that can just fill whatever gap Dallas needs. If they need a left-handed floater, he's got it. If they need a right-handed floater, he's got it. If he can throw a half-court alley-oop to Josh Green, if it's not going to get blocked by Naz Reid, he can do that too. I mean, the post moves, the, you know, Jaden McDaniels is having an incredible performance, but, or Jalen, excuse me, but, you know, he sneaks back door at one play early in the game. Like, it, Kyrie is just, this is exactly who they traded for, to your point. Even with all the baggage that Kyrie admitted he was bringing with him on his Southwest flight, not necessarily on the airline, but definitely in the direction from Brooklyn to Dallas. He said it post-game, game six, that, you know, he didn't have a simple path. I don't remember the exact quote, but something to those effects to get there. So it is absolutely an argument for just go out and get the all-star, which we will talk on a bit later more when we talk about the Sixers offseason plans. I think on the other side of that equation in this series, to your point about Rudy and drop, it was really interesting to watch Luka just kind of be able to toy with him once he got into the paint. Because I remember when I was working on a story about Mike Conley reuniting with Rudy Gobert in Utah, someone on the Jazz coaching staff for all those years of those guys together was saying that Conley was like the best that they'd ever seen with Rudy in particular. Throw kind of like a pitcher, when you get into the lane, you don't know whether it's a lob or a floater or if it's, you know, going to be high off the glass, or because he was so good at masking it. And it was just really fascinating to see Luka burn Rudy with that on the other end, play after play with Gafford.
You're absolutely right. You know, that cat and mouse game, the control. And I think that's like, this is, again, we'll get to the drop discussion, but like when it doesn't work well, it's loud. Like when you see a guy make a jumper with 5 feet of space around him in every direction or 8 feet of space around him, and you're like, well, why aren't you up on that guy? And then all the times where, you know, you are taking away that pass, or you are, you know, taking away, you're allowing your perimeter defenders to stay closer to their guys on the outside. So you're taking away the drive and kick to the open three and that kind of stuff. Like that's a quieter success and louder failure. And when Luke is doing it, it feels pretty loud, right? Like when those shots are going in and he's able to, you know, bump off, get to that step back, going to his left and just continually bang those jumpers. Or as you said, draw you one step further up, mask his intentions until the last second. And then is it a floater? Is it a lob? Is, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's 2 points on your head. Like having the patience to stay the course there is pretty, it's not something that everybody can do. And the Wolves were varying coverages on him, right? You know, it was drop with Rudy. It was when it was Kat or Naz Reid on the as the screen defender, they were blitzing a lot more often. They were playing up at the level of the screen right from the beginning. Like at the very, and I think Luka probably intentionally, like the first couple of pick and rolls that he ran, one was at Rudy and then one was at Kat. And it was like, well, let's see how they're doing it. Like, are they dropping Kat or are they going to vary depending on who I bring in, just so he can read out the game. And because he, you know, is like a supercomputer for that, then okay, well, if they're varying their coverages this way, how can I manipulate that to create, you know, make sure this guy's the low man so that I'm getting the rotation that I want, yada, yada, yada. I want to go back to the fourth quarter with Luka, because I think he was 7 for 19 or something like that heading into the fourth quarter. And then it just like he got cooking, you know, his personal 7-0 run, making shots over Jaden McDaniels, making shots over Nickeil Alexander-Walker early in the fourth quarter when Minnesota had gotten back up. There was that moment where he catches the ball and has a chance to take the catch and shoot three. It reminded me so much of Harden, which is stylistically somebody that
very Harden-esque.
Yeah, somebody that, you know, that comparison continues to be drawn. And he's like, I'm not going to take this catch and shoot three. I need Ant to come up so I can like bump him off and then get to my left to cash in the step back. Like that's the more rhythm shot for him. The shot that is harder for 99.9% of shooters is the one that he's like, that's how I feel alive. I need to bump this guy off and then get back to do it. But then going back to that sort of the cat and mouse game, Luka making his impression, his presence felt on defense late in this game. One, there's, you know, he gets the steal on a Jaden McDaniels pass, and Jaden McDaniels kind of, he's dribbling up the court because Anthony Edwards is waving him up the court saying, you take it up, I'm exhausted, which I'm guessing we'll get back to. But Jaden McDaniels gets under the rim, gets into traffic, has to just throw the ball somewhere. Luka picks it off, hit ahead, swing, swing. They get the PJ Washington corner three. PJ had not given them very much in the first half, but huge shot late in the game, just as we had seen so many times in the OKC series. And then on the other end, Luka winds up in the drop on Mike Conley driving at him, and Rudy's in the pick and roll, you know, lurking in the dunker spot behind him. And Luka has to be the defender playing the cat and mouse game, bait and switch. And he baits Conley into throwing the lob. And then Luka, with the knee injuries that he's dealing with and everything else,
and the refs he has to work against every game, they're always in cahoots against him, apparently.
Of course, you know, yeah, Sisyphus rolling the boulder up the hill, and the boulder is three guys in gray and black t-shirts with Emirates patches on them now. But he's able to get up. He gets up, and he gets up enough to deflect the ball away from the 7-foot-1 Rudy Gobert waiting to catch it and dunk it. And then comes down the other end. And again, we talked about the way he was manipulating the pick and roll coverages. He knew that late in the game, Minnesota had switched the coverages and said, we're going to bring Rudy to the level. We're going to blitz. And he says, get out of here. I don't want to screen. Flatten out. I'm going to take Jaden McDaniels, all 6'10", you know, whatever, 9.5-foot wingspan or whatever the hell he's got, all defensive second team. And I'm all NBA first team. And I'm going to put my cinder block ass shoulder into this dude's chest. And again, step back, cash. Like he was the best player on the floor in this game. He showed a capacity to control the game with his playmaking, then with his shot making, and then even contribute out with out on defense. Like this is the best version of Luka that we have seen. And that is a scary, scary proposition if you're Minnesota in this series.
Yeah. There was so much attention on the Luka versus Lu Dort matchup in the last series. Someone even texted me yesterday, a personal friend, not an NBA person, who just happened to bump into Lu Dort. And they texted me, how big is Luka Doncic? Because Lu Dort is a mountain and Luka's right. Bigger than him. And you would think that Jaden's length would be something to, you know, thwart Luka's Lukaness. But the weight differential, I'm not saying that's like KO, Jaden can't guard him. I'm just saying it's such a different task that Luka has to navigate. And it might be an easier one. I don't know. It'll be borne out over the next however many games this series goes. But it's just a very different matchup, a very different primary matchup that Luka is drawing series to series. Couple of thoughts that I just jotted down while I was watching the 40-minute version back this morning on all possessions on League Pass with Arugula next to me on the couch. You mentioned the gray jersey guys. Shout out to Mark Davis for the review saying the subtle but effective shove by Mike Conley. I liked that. Subtle but effective, I hope, is what people say about our show.
Yeah, we're real subtle.
Shout out to Deshaun Nix's orange jumpsuit on the bench, because wow, if there's a two-way guy who needed to figure out a way to get himself on the national radar, even the slightest, follow note, because I saw that guy every single fucking play. And he's up. Luka Garza is up, flexing. Going along the Jaden aspect of how long he is, both these teams are huge.
Absolutely huge.
And like Indy and Boston are big too. At one point on Tuesday night, I caught myself thinking, wow, and Boston's going to get KP back too. Like there's going to be more size entering the court, to the point where I found my, I know this is not where this series is like going to live or die. I just found myself so drawn to the Cat PJ Washington matchup because they're both a mismatch against the other defensively. And or I guess however you want to spin it, you know, the offensive player has the mismatch in both, I believe, on both sides of the floor. And it was particularly interesting to me in the 4-5 pick and roll that Minnesota has kind of adapted as one of their bread and butters, because they kind of figure out ways to make it, to sneak it into like the back end of whatever action they're starting. Like you don't really necessarily know it's coming because Cat's got it in a DHO, and then all of a sudden the guard just runs off, and then there's Rudy, and all, oh, 4-5 pick and roll. And that's the kind of stuff that like Chris Finch has dreamed of dating back to his years coaching in, you know, British ball. So it's interesting to me to like just watch that matchup for, because there's all this other stuff going on, but that's just one microcosm of the chess match, that it's like a horse versus a bishop or whatever you want to say, that like they got moves the other piece can't do.
The piece is called a knight.
You could call it a horse.
I mean, yeah, you could. Huh. You're right. And so I in this case, is Cat the horse because he took the L? He had to. But
it's pretty good.
Well, yeah, I'm a professional broadcaster. I'm going to wind up going back to rewatch some more of this as I write about it. So I'm going to be doing some like look ahead, walk up stories for like, you know, coming up for game two, some things to keep an eye on. I did one for, I just went up this morning at Yahoo Sports for Celtics Pacers game two. You can keep an eye on those. There will be another one of those tomorrow for this series. The fact that Minnesota was opening with Cat post-ups on PJ Washington was interesting to me. And I wonder if it was similarly, like I said, Luka runs the first pick and roll at Gobert, and he runs the second pick and roll at Cat to see if the coverage differentiates. I wonder if part of that was just like Finch and Mike Anori and the staff wanting to see, all right, just like, we want to see how they're going to guard those post-ups. Like, we want to get Cat involved. We want Cat to be an active participant in the offense, but we think that they're going to like, they're not going to like that matchup. And then Dallas didn't. Like, immediately, Daniel Gafford is there on the catch to double on the pick and roll and to show help, aggressive help behind. And Kyrie is sinking off the corner to tag Rudy. And that Minnesota, very understandably, is thinking like, okay, 7'1" center versus 6'3" guard. Like, we're going to put the ball up. And Cat, and as you mentioned, Cat in those 4-5 pick and rolls, in those high lows, like, he's super willing to feed Rudy. I think he might have had like more assists to Gobert than Ant did this season, or something like that. I forget the exact numbers, but the Cat, very willing passer to Rudy in those setups.
I think partially because, not to play armchair psychologist, partially because I think Cat wants us to know he can pass. Like, he's like doing the thing where he's holding a Statue of Liberty and whoop, like he's trying to kind of put sauce on it too, to kind of emphasize, I got these skills.
Yeah. And some, even like the, when you mentioned the 4-5 lob, and he's like sort of throwing it, and he's like, kind of like holds his hand up like it's his release. Like he's flicking in a floater, but it's the lob pass. I think you're absolutely right about that. Opens up a skip to Mike Conley in the corner. But you know, Dallas is ready for that. Minnesota is ready. Like they understand the matchup there, but I think a lot of this winds up coming back to like, where can you maneuver Cat on the chessboard to maximize his effectiveness? Because, you know, 6-for-20, obviously the percentage is not it, but like the kinds of shots Cat was getting also not necessarily, I think, what Minnesota might have wanted. The frequency and the style, you know, where the touches were coming from. It feels like they're going to need a lot more from Karl-Anthony Towns in this series as an attacking PJ Washington, maybe some of it is just like, instead of waiting for the playmaking out of the post, just taking them or going up over the top of them, trying to be more aggressive in that way. But the reason that becomes a bigger issue is because Minnesota just really wasn't getting any rim pressure, any downhill attacking anywhere in game one. Mentioned earlier, the 3-point shooting, 18-for-49 from 3-point range for Minnesota, new franchise high for 3-point attempts in a playoff game, ties a franchise high for 3-point makes in a playoff game. the most three-pointers they've taken in any game this season. And but like no interior pressure, 14 for 25 at the rim. And so much of that, it goes back to Anthony Edwards. So when you were looking back at it this morning, what, you know, what stood out to you from Ant's performance in game one?
I think with that length, like he airmailed three cross-court passes out of
yes,
bounds.
Yes, he did.
And definitely saw to that points in the paint aspect, saw a little maybe a reversion to his early days of just head faking and the closeout and getting it to the elbow and pulling up from mid-range, which is a fine shot for him. But I definitely know that coaching staff over the years have been imploring him to get your head down and get to the rim because you're a freak of nature and no one can really guard you there. There was that one play at the end of the third, I remember, where he did that and he kind of like double pumped and the ball trickled out of bounds and, you know, the whistles weren't as easy to come by for him. So maybe that was part of it. But I definitely felt some like drive and kick OKC vibes from Minnesota, even on like Rudy Gobert's short roll. Like it did seem like there was a lot of emphasis, maybe not even intentionally, but like it just every time that there was a kind of, you could kick it out or, you know, keep that roll or the drive or whatever, it kind of felt like the ball was always going back out to the perimeter, which maybe is a continued impact of Derek Lively, who just sticks out like a sore thumb. Or I have the image of the Roadrunner from Coyote and Roadrunner stuck in my head watching him run from that Chet Holmgren chasing him with his curly hair flowing in the wind, that like still I can't unsee it. But it's not a bad thing. It's just he's so skinny and so long and runs very well and is so at offensively he was so great too. Like the Euro step he had in the lane, the passing is really impressive. But yeah, like he's gonna get whistled and he did for defensive 3 seconds. And I know the Thunder were definitely a little upset about how it happened once in game six, but like that he probably should have been called a couple more times. Like if he's just going to be allowed to camp out in the lane and he's so like I was asking a coach this earlier in the week, like I don't even know what you call the zone that Dallas was using. It would look similar to what they did in, cause it's not a 2-3 matchup when like the two guys on the baseline, like outside the paint, outside Lively are guarding all the way up to the wing and Lively can shoot out to the corner and like still recover into the paint. It's amazing how much, I mean, I remember the early days of Sixers bloggers tracking Nerlens Noel track all over the floor. And it's like, it seems even more graceful because Nerlens was just kind of like a Bambi on ice, like skittering around. Like Lively seems very in control. And I'm not saying he's the sole reason for walling off the paint, but he's as big as any, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, and the numbers bear that out, right? You know, like he performed really well last night, 9 points, 11 rebounds. You mentioned 3 assists, a couple of blocks, 27 minutes off the bench, game high plus 19. Single game plus minus can be a high variance number. You spread it out over a longer sample, though, and you're, it can tell you some things. The Mavs have now outscored teams by 106 points in 287 minutes with Lively on the court in these playoffs. They've been outscored by 63 in 337 minutes without him there. Not saying that that is like Daniel Gafford sucks and Derek Lively's awesome. I don't think that's the case. But the impact he is making when he is in the game has been substantially positive for Dallas. And the defensive end, like, part of it, as you mentioned, is just like the shots that go away when you are able to have your center zoning up in the way that he is. Part of it is when you actually do, you know, pierce through the zone or penetrate into the paint, he has been super effective at contesting, limiting the opponent's shot percentages. Like Minnesota went, this is NBA.com's shot tracking. So different, you know, synergies is different than second spectrums is different than whatever. So take it with a grain of salt. And the matchups can sometimes get a little bit janky in there. Minnesota went 7-for-18 when shooting against Derek Lively last night, 38.9%. Opponents this over the course of this postseason, 68-for-162. So that's 42% when he's the guy defending the shot. the expected average for those shots is almost 10% higher. So Lively is dropping them by 9.5%. 47 guys have defended at least 100 shots. That's the biggest differential. He is making the largest negative impact on opponents' shots of any player to guard a high number in this postseason. So sometimes it's loud with the big alley-oops or the big shot blocks, and a lot of times it's quiet, but the impact is real. You mentioned the Oklahoma City series where it just seemed like Shea continually couldn't get downhill, or whenever Shea or Jalen Williams or whoever wound up getting into the teeth of the defense, it always was kicking back out. I do not think it is a coincidence that Anthony Edwards took 4 shots inside the arc in game 1, only 3 of them in the paint, and he only made 1. I think that is indicative of Dallas's defensive approach. I think a lot of it, though, is indicative of Anthony Edwards maybe needing to just sort of see, like, if I'm being shaded, I might need to just blast through the wall there. You mentioned the play where the ball trickled out of bounds. I think Kyrie might have gotten a strip on it when it went out. It's hard. It's going to be really hard to do, but he's going to have to do it. And it becomes an even trickier job when you are guarding Kyrie Irving all over the floor. That was at a sort of a much made of that matchup, I think. But the quote that Anthony Edwards had after the game, "We was a step behind everybody, especially myself. Kyrie got a transition layup from, I think, when we scored, and he just outran me. I was just exhausted." This is going to be really hard, and Dallas knows it. I think it goes back to, you were talking about Kyrie's leadership and the sense of, like, having been there before. They know that how they need to punish Minnesota's coverages in the series. They know how they're going to need to try to choke out that offense. Anthony Edwards is the head of the snake, and if you're going to make it really, really hard for him to get into the teeth of the defense, get downhill, it's going to make it much tougher for on everybody else. You need so much more from Towns in that setup. You need so much more from Mike Conley in that setup. You can't rely on Jaden McDaniels having the game of his life every night, right? So I think there's plenty to clean up here on both sides of it, but to me, that's where it really starts. If Anthony Edwards can't be the rim-pressuring, downhill creative force, it's going to be really tough for Minnesota to score enough.
The Mavericks, when they made the Western Conference Finals in 22, definitely had an air of, we're happy to be here. This team is very different. They were all to a man speaking to that effect after they knocked off OKC. And this was a game where they were in it all the way through. Sure, they fell down by 8-ish a couple of times, and every single time that happened, if you haven't been following Dallas, come back from 30 or whatever it was to the Clippers. They didn't win that game, but they clawed back and made that a contest. They were down 16, if I remember correctly, at the half against OKC at home in game 6. This team also very capable of playing from behind. So even if Minnesota jumps out and they get out to a strong start again, like, I will not count this Dallas team out. I don't think you should either. We've talked about them a lot. Any final thoughts on this series, or should we go forward with the rest of our programming?
Yeah, just last thing, because we talked about it, the drop defense discussion. Dallas's offensive rating in game 1 was below their average in the postseason, way below their regular season efficiency. Dallas went like 45% from mid-range. They barely got any threes up. They were bad from three-point range. Minnesota was plus 10 with Rudy Gobert on the floor. They gave up a point per possession with Rudy Gobert on the floor. I understand why it becomes a talking point, and I understand why, Stan Van Gundy was harping on it, why it was something that the Inside the NBA guys talked about, Draymond Green brought up, and it's going to be a discussion point. Like, can you win with Rudy Gobert dropping in the series? I don't think Minnesota lost that game on defense. I think Minnesota lost that game because Dallas's defense is for real and made it really, really hard for, Minnesota's main guys to score. And so I think that's where, of course, you need to be aware of it. You need to be cognizant of the shots you're giving up, and you got to make it as tough as possible for Luka and Kyrie to do it. But I don't think the answer is, we're going to shut Kyrie and Luka's water off forever. It's, we need our guards, our perimeter players, our offensive guys to be able to meet their level. And that's the way that Minnesota has won all season. I think that's where they need. They need better Ant. They need better Cat. They need better Conley. And they need Rudy to keep making, putting a lid on that defense so they can play everything 2-on-2, keep the perimeter players in check. So I think there's a long way to go in this one. I think I had picked Wolves in 7 before this one started. I expected to go the distance. And Dallas draws first blood, man. Really, really impressive performance.
Let's switch it up to Cleveland. where right before we began recording, news broke, as expected, I would say. I think this has been kind of had a feeling of inevitability since December that Cleveland would be parting ways with head coach JB Bickerstaff, which I'm just going to say from the jump, it always felt weird to me that the Cavs kind of intentionally fumbled the last game of the regular season in order to get into the 4-5 preferable matchup to advance in the postseason to then fire the coach that would have taken them further than they've ever gone without LeBron in 2 decades. Because it has seemed clear through the intel channels around the league that Bickerstaff was not someone that Donovan Mitchell and other players were behind. And that is a key ingredient to Cleveland's offseason, as the entire league will wait to see if Donovan agrees to a contract extension. He becomes eligible to sign, which is roughly 4 years, $200 million, give or take, which will be a huge domino in the overall offseason landscape that we will touch on even more after the ad break, after we do a little Cavs analysis here. Because look, you have the numbers in our rundown: 170-159 record, 517 win percentage over 4+ seasons, and they've gotten better every year. So this is clearly not a, and I'm sorry to just point the finger where it seems obviously to be pointed. Like, this is not a, this guy didn't get us far enough situation. So I have some names to say, but I just, in the interest of not me talking for 2 straight minutes, what was your initial thoughts here on Bickerstaff being dismissed?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about it after the Cavs got eliminated in last week's show. And I think if there's a, you know, there's a little bit of damned if you do, damned if you don't. You're right. They've gotten better year over year under JB Bickerstaff. He gets fired after a season where he only had his core guys, Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, Evan Mobley, and Jared Allen, together for 32 of their 94 total games. You know, they still win 48 games. They still get a top 4 seed, and they still win a playoff series. But I think it's understandable. Like, there's the X's and O's kind of schematic idea, and then there's also just like the interpersonal stuff. I think it's reasonable to look at their offense and the way that their team performed and say it should be better than this. The talent did not surpass the sum of its parts in terms of the way the offensive structure was working. Still too much your turn, my turn. Obviously a stagnant season for Darius Garland, so on and so forth. Really what it comes down to, though, I think you're right. Like, if the players, if you're not getting what you need to get out of the players, if the players aren't listening, right? If the message is falling on deaf ears, if they don't have confidence in what you're presenting to them, rightly or wrongly, like maybe JB Bickerstaff, maybe they should be more, whatever, you know, but it's immaterial at a certain point. Like, if they are not comfortable in that, if they're not confident in it, then the message isn't going to get across and somebody else needs to be delivering them, whether the message is dramatically different or not. And so, similar to what we heard about, you know, what we talked about with Darvin Ham in LA or with Frank Vogel in Phoenix, like, the responsibility falls on the coach. He's the one that falls on the sword. But it's about, can you connect with the players? Can you maximize what you're getting out of them? And it remains to be seen who will be able to get more out of that structure. But if job one is keep Donovan Mitchell, keep him happy, and if the state of affairs was the, whether it's Mitchell himself or multiple players in the locker room or whatever, the reporting has been kind of anonymous and mixed and varied, but like, if the, you know, you need to be, do whatever, give yourself the best chance of making that guy happy enough to keep around. And if a new offensive voice and structure is needed, you know, that JB Bickerstaff winds up being the cost of doing business for that. And it's an ugly bit of business, but you know, you can, it's not the first time that's happened.
Yeah. It's a really pivotal offseason for this front office, where Kobe Altman got extended, forget exactly when, over the last couple of years, but in this post-Donovan Mitchell trade era. And now this big four that they've put together is clearly super talented, but the fit questions have obviously been there in both the backcourt and the frontcourt, which we discussed last week. It's interesting though, being that like, if it's hard to recall, but JB Bickerstaff is another guy just like Jock Vaughn in Brooklyn, where he was the interim head coach after John Beilein resigned
during that disastrous
Cavs year. And he did a good job and he kept the gig. Like, this has not really been, I mean, the Beilein situation was what it was, but this hasn't really been a job that this front office has went out and had a coaching search for half a decade now. So that's, I mean, definitely not since before they had Donovan Mitchell. The proverbial thinking around the league is kind of like, as far as scapegoating goes, and that's not to say this is necessarily what's happening here, but you know, the front office fires, it's the same thing happening in Brooklyn. Front office fires the coach, and then will you get to hire another one is kind of the next question in the line of questioning that doesn't count in the other line of questioning. Do you get that reference? Do you get that
one? Wow. No, I don't, but I feel like I'm trapped in my own mind, which is pretty good.
That's from Austin Powers with Will Ferrell playing the role of Mustafa.
Oh, I got, you know, maybe I'm due for a rewatch. It's been a little while.
He has to answer a question if you ask it three times in a row. That's kind of the
Okay. That's right. I forgot that was a good bit. I mostly remember him falling into a pit and then talking about how much he was being burned.
The wound is beginning to smell a little like almonds. If you could send down some antibacterial cream. Austin Powers is canon in my household. So
I'm not here to suggest that it shouldn't be. We'll see.
How many podcasts are you going to get an Austin Powers impression right before I tell you that the names I'm hearing to replace JB Bickerstaff? Kenny Atkinson seems to be the leader in the clubhouse right now. His connection to Caris LeVert and Jared Allen from the Brooklyn days, I don't think are the connective pieces here. Being that Jared Allen, I think, is pretty widely expected to be available in trade conversations this summer. That's not to say that Cleveland's going to be shopping him, but that's to say there are plenty of teams who have interest, most notably the New Orleans Pelicans, I can say, from my conversations. We've known that for years now. And there will be others, for sure, especially as we've been talking about how all these teams that are still left are goddamn huge. And the fit with Evan and him just obviously has not been optimal. But James Borrego, Dave Yeager are two other former head coaches that I am being told are going to be under consideration here. The fourth name that I've been texted just now and I've heard through the ether previously would also go to the Donovan Mitchell of it all, Johnny Bryant, former Utah assistant who was Donovan's guy, who worked for the Knicks, who many viewed that as a connective piece potentially before they would have acquired him instead of going to Cleveland. So those are the four names I've got. I'm sure there'll be others, but it does seem like, I mean, the bulk of these names are proven or guys who have done it before, which would seem to be the case. I don't think this team that got to the second round and was dissatisfied with the performance of the head coach for various other reasons that we, you know, obviously discussed, is going to go give this to some first time guy, unless there's some real connectivity between that franchise and the players involved and what have you. So it'll be interesting to see which one emerges. This has been probably one of the dizzier coaching cycles in recent memory to me, being that a lot of these have kind of waited a little while, even though things have been expected and whatnot. And the Wizards job is still ongoing. You know, Kenny Atkinson was definitely a name involved in the Wizards search. And there was a lot of thought around the league that like his next job post Brooklyn after being years in Golden State, kind of similar to Mike Brown in Sacramento, even though obviously that team went right and got the three seed. And now they're not getting the three seed as part of that equation, but that's getting off task. There was definitely expectation around the league that like Kenny's next job would be one of those more developmental, you know, team on the up and up, which in theory Cleveland still kind of is, but there's obvious expectations there now. So that would be a much different circumstance, probably a better circumstance, I would say, for Kenny Atkins personally, probably to even like shed that I'm a rebuild guy label. So, yeah, I mean, Borrego's obviously been characterized as like the number two choice behind JJ Redick in Los Angeles. He was involved in Brooklyn. So his name's been super hot this coaching cycle as well, after being the lead assistant in New Orleans this year. Dave Joerger joined Doc Rivers in Milwaukee midseason and has kind of been doing a little rehabilitation after his flame out with Sacramento, first with Doc in Philly and other places, what have you. Definitely, like, of this list, he's kind of like the outside the box thinker by reputation that could, in theory, just like we're talking about the Chris Finch 4-5 pick and rolls, that could figure out something to do with this lineup as currently constructed, try to figure out a better synergy with the two guards and the two bigs. But this is so early, and we will figure out more later, because again, this news just broke right before we started recording. This is pretty much all I can give you at this juncture.
Yeah, the only thing that is immediately made me, like, I had to cast my mind back, like, oh right, Dave Joerger coached those like Marc Gasol, Zach Randolph, Memphis teams. Also, the only guy of this group that we're talking about that's won a playoff series, right? Like, James Borrego not in Charlotte, Kenny Atkinson not in Brooklyn. So, like, but yeah, it's. I don't have any new original thoughts to add about that, except that the names that we're talking about and the initial sort of forwarded suggestions don't jump off the page as like JB Bickerstaff got us to the precipice of being able to get over the hump. These are the guys with the proven track record to be able to do it, right? Like, not a whole lot of postseason success in that group, not a ton of proven experience deep into the, like, so it's interesting. I think where I landed last week was, again, like, I understood the arguments for moving on from JB Bickerstaff, but also it's a, be careful what you wish for, because, you know, the grass is not always greener with whoever you bring in. And so that's where, you know, Cleveland clearly felt, I mean, I think the fact that the immediate aftermath of their season ending was like knives out stories suggested that even no matter how long they took and how carefully they thought out their coaching situation, it seemed like it was pointing toward a pretty clear endpoint. And now we have arrived at it.
Hasn't been a lot of postseason success in Philadelphia of late. We will touch more on the Sixers' plans to remedy that after we pay some bills and take a quick ad break. Welcome back to No Capper here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. I'm gonna steal Vinny Gopo's line. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We spoke plenty in the first half about all these teams that are loaded, not just with size, but with all stars and all NBA talent. And that has been the plan in Philadelphia ever since Daryl Morey got there, dating back to Sam Hinkie. When Sam Hinkie, a Daryl Morey lieutenant, arrived in Philadelphia and showed a PowerPoint to Sixers ownership that detailed all the moves they did to trade for James Harden, being that all-stars win championships. The only ways you can get all-stars are pretty, you know, and I get anybody through the draft, through trade, through free agency. And the easiest path to doing that is by drafting them at the top, where you can get Joel Embiid. But when you have $65 million in cap space and you have Joel Embiid and you have an all-star in Tyrese Maxey, the Sixers, now under Daryl Morey's stewardship, certainly believe that they are a very appealing option for a third all-star or all-NBA caliber player to come on and join. And I know we've talked about it on the show. I know Sixers fans have debated the merits of that outcome versus splitting that salary into two or three different players and having more depth. But the data is abundant. And more recently, according to team building data reviewed by Yahoo Sports, this is all from an article that we're dropping today, that published while we're recording, but it I haven't tweeted published. It out. It's has published.
Yeah.
People reacting to it already?
Oh, I don't know. I just seen that the link actually went up. So
based off your tone, I was wondering. Anyway, so the chance a team reaches the conference finals nearly doubles from 18.5% to 30.8% when a roster has three top players compared to two top players. And according to this study, top players means someone who was an all-star or on an all-NBA team within 2 years of the current season, before or after, so either window, and played 29-plus minutes per game. That data with the numbers, I was told, was because the Spurs did not have anyone play over 30, famously. I think that was the 13-14, whatever year Kawhi won Finals MVP when they beat Miami. All the years went together. So 9 of the last 11 title winners, so since that 12-13 season, have all had 3-plus top players by that rubric. Only 2, last year's Nuggets, Nikola Jokic was Denver's sole all-star or all-NBA talent. The 2020 Lakers had LeBron and AD. Literally everyone else has had 3-plus, the plus being Golden State's 4 guys. And this is why Brooklyn went out and traded for James Harden when they already had Kyrie and KD. It's why Matt Ishbia is claiming that 26 other teams would want the Suns roster, because in theory, they've got 3 all-stars. They've done that part of the job. That is the hardest part of the job to do. Rounding it out from there should be, again, in theory, easier than getting those guys. It's not going to be so, so easy for Philly, because in theory, they could just open their door with warm arms and a warm embrace and give Paul George the maximum contract that, by all accounts, doesn't really seem like the Clippers are willing to give him right now. And make no mistake, like, Paul George, from my understanding, is the Sixers' top choice. I think that's a pretty wide open secret. We've kind of been writing that since the day after the deadline ended. I've learned more post-combine and on the phone that would make me think that there's definitely a real possibility here. The first is that, you know, Kawhi's contract, do you remember the numbers on that, Dan? The extension that he signed?
It was sub-max, right? It was 3,150?
Correct. The 3 seems to be a very important number. Because, and I don't know if this is going to prove ironclad, because again, this is all just preliminary and no conversations can be had.
Yeah, we're all just speculating in a sandbox that's not real. About, it's like, you know, like the old NCAA games that didn't have players' names. It's like, could be, you know, we're talking about HB26. That's all we're talking about right now.
We will see once conversations beyond extensions that are eligible to be discussed and have been throughout the season can be legal to discuss. But there is a sentiment going around the league right now that the Clippers are not very keen on awarding any money guaranteed beyond the 3-year window of Kawhi's deal. So even if it doesn't require a max to get Paul George out of LA, in theory, it could just take 4 years of guaranteed money, because that could be the difference of $40 million for the guy. Other thing that I don't necessarily think is going to actually be a real talking point, but maybe it does become one because I heard it from multiple people. If Paul George does reach the open market, does become an unrestricted free agent without an extension, he is then eligible with the Clippers to get a no trade clause, which any interested team outside of Los Angeles will kind of be telling Paul, my guy, look what they just did to Blake Griffin a couple years ago. They showed his jersey in the rafters and they traded his ass. So don't you want a no trade too? Of course, there's only one in the league right now, and it significantly handicapped the Wizards' efforts to offload Bradley Beal. But if we hear things about a no trade clause with Paul George being something he wants and the Clippers not giving it to him come June 30th, because again, that's when they're first able to discuss that, I will be interested if that comes to fruition. Also working in Philly's favor, and other teams like Orlando that's been mentioned, New York's been mentioned, the East is way weaker than the West. And I wonder if that will be, all those confluence of factors will be enough to lure Paul George away from the city, his hometown, that he, of course, wanted to go to, dating back to when he was in Indiana. And Magic Johnson got dinged for talking about him on Jimmy Kimmel and all that type of stuff.
The wink, right? Magic winking and being like, yeah, and, you know, then, yeah, getting fined. Magic's tenure as an executive, it was really wonderful. It was really, really funny. Also, it was, the fact that Paul George can negotiate a no-trade clause with the Clippers makes me feel ancient. Because the rule on that in the CBA, I just looked it up on Larry Kuhn's CBA FAQ, is you got to be in the league for more than 8 years and with the team that you'd be signing with for more than four. So, like, Paul George is well over 8 years in the league, well over a decade in the league, and he's been with the Clippers for, like, five. How long? Like, when did things happen? Like, where did it go, Jake? Where has it gone? I'm, like, melting. My face is just melting in real time.
I still remember being in the Uber with, I don't remember exactly who I was with, which is funny. In Vegas, Summer League.
I still remember what I don't remember from Vegas.
I remember being in, it wasn't even early. It was just going to dinner. We were leaving the arena. And it might have been a late night dinner, because that's how things go. And getting the push alert, Kawhi to the Clippers, Paul George is coming. Like, it definitely, that doesn't feel so long ago, but at one point, on the other hand, it feels like ancient history. If the Sixers can't get Paul George, there aren't that many options, though, for this plant. Like, LeBron ain't coming. I'm sorry. And even though they got a meeting with him in 2018. And I've heard from multiple agents that if their client wants to go to the Sixers, they're going to be advising that guy, are we sure you want to hitch your wagon to Joel Embiid, who's never proven to be healthy in the postseason? Which I've never really heard anyone say. So, like, I mean, it's kind of, it was like unanimous amongst people I was speaking to about this story. And when I just have been talking about Philly and the prospect of their cap space to people, it shouldn't come as a shock. Joel Embiid's been injured every single time he's been in the playoffs outside of the bubble. And that wasn't a very long run.
Yeah. And he just turned 30, you know, it's like, this is so funny. Like, Paul George being like, it's like, he's the bell of the ball. He can do whatever he wants. He can stay at home and make, you know, a king's ransom to play with a guy who's never healthy in the playoffs, or he can go to Philly and make a king's ransom to play with a guy who's never healthy in the playoffs. Like, it's true. The world's your oyster, Paul.
It's true. So the other options of, like, that tier of guy, DeMar DeRozan doesn't really make stylistic sense. He operates in the same mid-range area that Joel Embiid does. He's voiced his public wants to go back to Chicago. The only other name that
the
makes...
The unfinished business in Chicago.
Exactly. The only other name that really makes any sense to fit this two-way wing that the Sixers want that is even considerably close to this quote-unquote top player, it's OG Anunoby. And I'll say this. This is probably one of the more interesting things I've learned since my conversations around the Marriott Marquis in the South Loop. Pascal Siakam, OG's former teammate in Toronto, you know, messaging across the league, don't trade for me unless you're giving me the big bucks. He seems all but locked into Indiana. Definite word around the combine that OG Anunoby is not just a surefire return to the Knicks. Of course, New York has everything, every incentive to match whatever type of dollar. He's not a restricted free agent, right? He's gonna decline his 19.9. I cannot report definitively he's going to, but, like, come on, guys.
I will say, as the non-insidery guy, it would be shocking if he did not decline his $19.9 million player option to reach unrestricted free agency, because he might, like, double that or get close to it.
Correct. But I cannot say definitively. I do not have it from the horse's mouth. From the knight's mouth.
There's a couple of pawns on here talking.
Exactly. So, that being said, there are definite signals going out that if you want OG Anunoby, come and get him come June 30th. That he, at this juncture, will be open to listening to other teams, not the Knicks, which I know will be a little alarming to the Knicks faithful, to the side talk heroes out there. But it is, that was the one real juicy thing left in the notebook from the combine chatters. And the Sixers definitely were a team calling about OG back when he was with Toronto. There is some past history, of course, with Nick Nurse. From my understanding, I don't think they're like long lost best friends and just like want to reunite. But I think it's not a situation where there isn't but like good potential to, you know, reunite and what have you. And I expect him to go back to the Knicks. This could all also just be an attempt to get that higher number, to get the Knicks to give more. But it's just something that I've heard from multiple teams. Like, literally, I've only heard it from four, but I'm sure there's more. Four different teams told me, hey, we have received word that OG is not just a done deal back to the Knicks, and that we will be able to make an attempt to get him come June 30th. So, and that's again through the signals and the channels. We don't know where the word's coming from.
Sure.
It's in the wind.
Yeah. I mean, it makes all the sense in the world. Obviously, it benefits OG Anunoby and his representation greatly to generate the largest possible market for him to get the highest possible dollar figure on whatever deal he gets, whether that's in New York or elsewhere. It also makes all the sense in the world that a player who like doesn't need to be a high usage guy, is a high volume, high efficiency 3-point shooter, guards everybody at an all defensive team caliber level, and can scale up. I mean, like when he got hurt, he had just scored 28 points in 29 minutes, I think, in the playoffs. Like he's a guy you can win with who fits on every team. Every team could use an OG Anunoby. There's a reason why when the initial trade talks in Toronto were happening, it was like, is it 3 first round picks? Is it 4 first round picks? Is it whatever? And if all it's going to cost you to wind up getting him is money, get your bids up. I think that it makes all the sense in the world. Also, this is OG's third deal. The extension he's played on for where they signed in Toronto was, I think, 4 years, 72. So this is like the break the bank deal for OG Anunoby. And as we met, you know, as I said, when he got hurt in the playoffs, OG Anunoby has had injury issues in the past and has played, so if you are in his shoes and in his agent's shoes, like, this is where you need to hit your home run. Like, get the biggest deal possible for as long as possible to put your guy in position to play meaningful postseason games. He would make a ton of sense in Philly. I think maybe the potential saber rattling fear of like, you wouldn't, if you are the Knicks, you would not want to see him walk across the Atlantic Division to the team you just beat, that if they had OG Anunoby on their team, might have beat you. That's interesting. That certainly, were I a Knicks fan, it would concern me to some degree.
See your emotional reaction to that intel.
I'm trying to be professional about it, but I think the strongest case, I believe it was in the locker room after game 7, Josh Hart on the way out, like, pointed at OG Anunoby and Isaiah Hartenstein. I was like, those two guys better be back. And obviously, Josh Hart's not the one making those decisions, but I think there's a pretty strong sentiment among, the Knicks and Knicks fans and everybody else, like, this team, get this team back and get it healthy, because there's something real here. Losing OG Anunoby would be a significant blow, but you do wonder at some point if the price point becomes too high and who would wind up being part of it. So yeah, the fact that he might be actually really gettable, really available, that'll be something super, super, super fascinating to watch where his market lands.
Again, I expect him to go back to New York, but this is just what I'm hearing, and I heard it pretty definitively and resoundingly. So it was interesting, and I'm bringing it to you. I'm bringing it to the people. There's more in my article on yahoosports.com that is definitely up and live before you'll be hearing this. With alternative options for Philly, I do think if they strike out on those guys, they will look at similar 1+1 deals that Indiana did with Bruce Brown, because Indiana was able to flip that salary into Pascal Siakam. That is going to be the guiding light for the Sixers, as it's been. If they can't get the guy, they're willing to pay long-term money and to trade future picks to go compete for next year's title. They're willing to mortgage the future for the now, but only on real studs, real two-way wing studs. And if they can't get them now, I expect they will look at the KCPs of the world, the Klay Thompsons of the world, for similar one-year, one-plus-one balloon-type payments to try to maintain the flexibility to go trade for them. Because as this league always shows, there's always going to be someone coming around the pike who wants out or their team doesn't want to pay them, and opportunity will be there no matter what. So that's it. After all the troubles that you guys probably didn't even know about, thanks to our brilliant editing team, that is all we've got for you today. Thanks to substitute producer Joe DeLeone in today for our regular super producer, John Gennaro, who does, they both do all the things to make this show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. That would be so, so great. We thank you for listening. We'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.